just going on to have a crack. He is, you know. Oh, I say!
Welcome to Filthy Shambles, Season 3, Episode 37. I'm joined by Adam. Adam, this is a hat-trick, mate. Saw you twice on Saturday at the game.
I actually saw you another time, a third time. But so it's like a double hat-trick, I think is what we call it. But yeah, there we go.
Well, let's dive right in, because it's quite a lot to talk about. It's funny, when you're watching the game at the time, you really suffer, as we've done so for many years watching Tottenham. And then you come away thinking, was it half as bad as I thought it was at the time? Or was it half as bad as the people in front of me moaning all through the game? Were Luton lucky not to get a hiding on Saturday? Or was it another case of Spurs struggling to really be convincing? Are they one and the same thing in this instance? What do you reckon?
I think it was very much the sort of Alan Hansen game of two halves sort of thing. It was basically two completely separate matches for me. And the worrying part is that the team that Ange seems to be going with right now, with Maddison and Kulusevski, seems quite easy to neuter for any side, really. And we don't appear to be that dangerous, albeit we did miss a couple of chances. But in a general play standpoint, no one could look at that first half and thought we played well. But second half, when he had a second winger on the pitch and were able to maximise the whole space of what's going on, we're like a different team, and we could have scored seven or eight goals just from crosses in the second half on Saturday. If anything, the defender who smacked one in for the equaliser probably did the worst job with the easiest one he had to clear, because he made three or four other really good clearances ahead of Werner at the back post. So one of the best things about Ange, I think, is the way he's picked stuff up and learnt it as the season's gone on. And I really hope that he looks at the fact we haven't scored a goal in seven first halves, all of which I think Maddison and Kulusevski have played together. And I think that's quite indicative of the big issue that we've got from a selection standpoint. That said, he's been able to change it in almost all those games apart from Fulham, and it's reaped rewards.
So what is the Kulusevski issue? Because, like, what is he trying to do here? Is he trying to play the Maddison role? Is he cutting in and trying to be too influential through the congested middle, rather than playing as a wide player, as a winger? Because earlier in the season, you know, he had a lot of success. In fact, the constant criticism of Kulusevski has usually been that he takes one touch too many. He cuts in, he's forgotten how to take a shot, he's forgotten how to try and go towards scoring rather than looking for often an impossible pass. And you know, the way Luton scored was almost comical, in that we lost the ball in an attacking area and failed to really defend on the back foot on the counter. So what is it exactly about Maddison and Kulusevski that isn't working? And why does someone like Brennan Johnson come on and galvanise the entire dynamic of the team? I mean, completely changes instantly. We're finding diagonal balls through to the wing, and we look like we're going to score, like you said, six, seven, eight times. We were in a position where we should have done better.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's a Kulusevski problem on an individual basis. I think Kulusevski is a brilliant player, but he himself has said a number of times, including that Players Tribune thing that he did, that he probably sees himself as a central player. He obviously got quite a nice taste of that when Maddison was out and he played more central, and maybe he just enjoyed it and is looking to get more involved. I think Postecoglou spoke quite well about it after the game, by saying that, you know, he tried to get too involved in the game. That's what he wants to do. That's the kind of player he is. I thought that was quite telling. But like, just from a super reductive standpoint, if you continued the line of the edge of the penalty box to the wings, if that makes sense, right? So imagine the line of the penalty area goes all the way across the pitch. Those sort of squares between the corner flag and the 18-yard box, so many of our goals this year have come from a ball from that square. And when Kulusevski's there, because he wants to cut inside, you kind of just lose that whole square of the pitch to use. And that's where Johnson attacks and creates so much from that space. And I just don't think it's a surprise at all that it took like 4 minutes for us to isolate that space when he came on and score a goal exactly like that. I mean, the weird thing is that, you know, we scored so many goals from that Newcastle game on December 9th, I think it was, up until, when do we have a break? Sort of after the Brighton game, which was, what, mid-Feb? We scored so many goals from crosses that were just cutbacks or whip balls across. And then Ange went back to a team with Kulusevski there that doesn't really have the capacity to score those goals, because the idea of one winger playing to the other just doesn't really exist with Kulusevski, which isn't his fault, I don't think. It's just the way he plays. And so I'm quite surprised that he went back to a situation where we basically took away our biggest threat. And yeah, I don't think it was a surprise at all that when he's gone back to it in games like Brentford and on Saturday, that it reaps the rewards so, so quickly, because it just feels like it makes the pitch feel 20 yards bigger, which it kind of does.
So, I mean, do you think Ange has learned from this? I mean, just in terms of what we got. I mean, we've got a game almost immediately, right? We've got a game tomorrow. We're recording on Monday. We've got a game on Tuesday against West Ham. I mean, he sticks with Brennan Johnson now, right? Just in terms of I mean, actually, the question I wanted answered, if possible, was, or discussed, was, has he seen this? Because, like you said, we've been playing like this in the same way for quite a few games. It's not quite clicked. It's not quite worked. Surely, you know, there's something to be done beyond stubbornness of trying to play a player into a performance of influence. Surely we just go back to basics here because it works so effectively. Because if he doesn't and he sticks with Kulusevski again, then there's obviously question marks. We're obviously seeing something that he's not seeing. Mm-hmm. If he's persisting with that player. It just seems to me that it's, especially this, at the back end of the season, we're trying to pick up as many points as we can. Just go back to the basics, surely, just to get into winning momentum, because we're running out of games now.
Yeah, I think West Ham probably provide a little bit of a weird wild card scenario, because the set piece threat they've got is so dangerous that, and this is really boring and kind of negative thinking, but I wonder if he'd want to take out a 6'2" player for a 5'7" player when we're not that tall of a side anyway. So there's a
physicality side. Yeah, that's
but I think Forest at home next Sunday now, that's the one where you would hope that he would go back to not worrying about anything the opposition have got to throw at us and just going full, you know, play it the way we want to play. So like, I'll be there tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it. But it wouldn't stun me if maybe he went to sort of Kulusevski, Richarlison and Son as the front three, just to get two bigger guys in there to nullify the threat of West Ham's set pieces. Because it's a weird sort of quirky game, this one, because you do have to match up and respect what the opposition can do, I think, from those set pieces, which, you know, that's all they're going to try and do.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's tricky enough as it is, that particular fixture. And talking of tricky, we've had a bunch of games really where we've struggled. Brentford, Brighton, Palace, Wolves. You know, I know we've won some of those games, but we've kind of struggled. I guess struggle there's context to the word struggle, because not every game is easy in the Premier League. We do make it difficult for ourselves in terms of how we start games, how we concede early and we have to come back. Do you think we're still struggling with the low block? I mean, what did you make of Luton? I mean, we could probably time waste half the podcast talking about their antics and them. It's really funny when they were falling over two at a time at one point. And once we equalised, no one was getting cramp after that, which I thought was incredible.
Yeah.
More cramp, lads. No, they're not going to have a little rest. No.
What drives me absolutely crazy about football, and I don't know if there's no real way around it, but Spurs score in the 86th minute and then they put 9 minutes of stoppage time up. So Luton waste all of that time when the result is going in their favour, And then when it's not going in their favour, they reap the reward again, potentially, of the time they've wasted. Like, there should be a way that Postecoglou can sort of say, no, we don't want the time added on now. Do you know what I mean? It's a bizarre quirk that you can sort of cheat the system
twice.
It's a complete hack.
I mean, I guess it'll get complicated for the referee and the officials to monitor what would quantify as genuine injuries and cramp. Do you know what I'm saying? Because you could say, well, look, time wasting isn't going to go on to injury time. But we're opening Pandora's box. I mean, it's been opened about a dozen times already with VAR. But I get what you're saying. It is a bit of a hack.
But then he scored in the 98th minute, and that would have just been so unfair because the time was only added on because of their pissing about.
Well, they got what they deserved in the end. I mean, I get it. I get the clubs like Luton, without being disrespectful, they've got to play a certain way to be able to look to gain the initiative and to pick up points in their bid to survive. You know, you can't expect teams like Luton to come to Tottenham and play openly because it will just allow us to really do all the good things that we're capable of and absolutely brush them aside. So yeah, you kind of get...
Job. It's the ref's job to sort it out.
100%. But the thing is, I know this has been... There's been a bit of a chat in the group chat that it does seem like Groundhog Day, right, in terms of this particular... performance. Not okay, I know Spurs play a part in it, but just in terms of the lack of kind of stern authority from the official in the middle of the park, you know, the fact that teams consistently play to time waste, it is the same script, just different actors. I mean, we should really be slapping these teams and not having to worry about all the little add-ons that obviously anchor the game to the point of us not breaking, but it's stressful enough when you're not smashing Luton at home when you're expected to do that just based on the difference in quality and everything else. But, you know, Spurs are Spurs. We've got our own problems that we create for ourselves, and then we just have to be better to not have to worry about all the other problems that the opposition bring. So first half was what it was. I think I heard some boos, which is always pantomime.
I feel like that was more at the ref, and there was a weird bit of time wasting towards the end of the first half, but...
I think it has been.
It has been a bit pedestrian watching these first halves of the last five or six games.
And yeah,
frustration is understandable. You know, we missed two really frustrating chances. Three, I think. There was another one that maybe Sun glazed over just before half time that you just think, come on, like, just score, get this nonsense over with. I never begrudge people being frustrated at times like that, really. I don't think it was anything more. It wasn't sort of like an Everton, you know, Goodison Park style howls of derision from the crowd. I just think people were a bit pissed off. But yeah, it was a weird first half. Obviously, they took the main chance they had, you know, decent counter attack. We seemed to make a lot of mistakes in it. But strange. My most pressing problem in the first half was forgetting my sunglasses and forgetting that the East Upper is bathed in sunshine when the sun's out. And so it's just all awful trying to cut my hands over my eyes to see what the hell was going on. So that was my biggest issue.
No, that's a classic. It reminds me, not that this is comparable, but the guy wearing his baseball cap back to front and putting his hand over his eyes. It's like, mate, you've got something on your head that can do that for you. Like, I mean, to be fair, if it was Conte was still the manager, it would probably be a benefit to be blinded by the sun. But people are frustrated, but it's funny that when we equalised, I mean, to be fair, even before there was a bit of positive singing and chanting and trying to get behind the team. I know we only really get up for games that are against really big tier clubs, like rival clubs. We always find our voice, but these are type of games where we quietly moan to the person sitting next to us until something happens, and then obviously. I had the bloke next to me actually kind of sort of elbow me and said, oh, look, they're singing Postecoglou's name now. we're a bunch of fickle supporters. And I just was like, yeah, that's exactly what football fans are. When things are going your way, you're more likely to break out in song. There's a few sort of talking points I just want to gauge your opinion on. I mean, I'm going to get to the midfield momentarily, but just on the subject of Maddison and Kulusevski, I know we've got the young guy Lucas Bergvall coming in the summer. We might do a lot more business in the summer. You know, Spurs will probably try and get that business done as quickly as possible to give Postecoglou, you know, the best possible pre-season. But do you think in terms of when you look at how we change dynamically with the winger, with Johnson, do you think we still need something different in the middle? Just based on the fact that you've got Timo Werner, who does all the hard work really easily and that just doesn't have that kind of clinical finish that a Son and a Kane has, right? He's 15 million quid. There's a conversation to be had there that 15 million quid is a no-brainer in terms of squad signing. However, there's also an argument to be made that if we want to make the jump the same way the scum over at the Swamp were in the same type of position we're in now, and they made their jump forward, and they've done it by spending a lot of money. Do we need to also do the same when you're looking at people like Timo? Because I want your opinion on Timo, and I also want your opinion on players like Basuma, who is someone I rate really highly, and yet I feel that he's letting himself down a little bit. He's not the player he's capable of, and I'm just thinking now, what's the exception and what's the rule with Basuma? So, Timo, Basuma, the mic is yours.
Basuma, I don't think there's much of an issue, to be honest. I think that the midfield has been quite sticky in the last few games, and I think Maddison's dropping too deep. I don't think the fullbacks are necessarily inverting in the same way. I think we've lost a bit of our rhythm that, you know, maybe having three games in a week might help get that back. I mean, look, if Basuma gets dropped on tomorrow for Bentancur, I'm not going to have many complaints or arguments about it, but outside of maybe fluffing the tackle for Townsend, I don't think Basuma did that much wrong on
that's
Saturday.
That's fair.
He certainly didn't stick out to me as an issue. Like I thought Maddison was far worse, to be honest, because I thought he was trying to get too involved, playing too deep. And if he is going to play sort of deeper than Basuma, well, there's no point in being there. I've been more frustrated by him. And when I think about his two main contributions since coming back from injury, you've got a goal against Aston Villa in the 6-yard box, and then against Palace, he turned into a captain, driving force, setting goals up, creating chances, was in and around the box much more. I just think he needs to stay much closer to Son where possible and kind of get out of the way of the rest of the players in build-up. Because I think every time he drops deep, it just leaves us numerically knackered up front, I think.
That's a really good point, you know. Because you often look at the midfield and you wonder why they're not as dominant and boss-like as they should be. Because on paper, you know, we should have Luton's mid in our back pocket. But you're right, Maddison has been dropping a bit too deep. And then obviously there's been the Kulusevski issue out on the wing and him driving through centrally. And then Basuma kind of gets lost in all the noise. And all the distortion. What about Timo? Because I like him. I do like him. I mean, I know the meme is that he cannot finish. He's a kind of a like a 3 or 4 chance player before he actually scores. But he's always in dangerous positions. He's always making something happen. He's always available for the delivery, and when we find him, your bum's off your seat and you're thinking something's going to happen here. But decision making, finishing is obviously the most important part, right, of the entire moveset. So where have you fallen with Timo thus far in terms of his time at Spurs?
I think he's been pretty much as advertised, but probably more dangerous than we would have expected. Like, he's not been anything like the meme player that, you know, some would have expected. You're right, he's missed a couple of chances, but he's made up for that in being involved in an awful lot of goals. You know, both goals on Saturday, you know, he causes the own goal by being there. The second goal, he picks out a really good pass to Johnson, who lays it off. The Johnson ball that somehow didn't cross the line, he puts Lo Celso through. And for 15 million, like in the NFL, which is sort of the other sport I follow, he would be called a draft hedge. So you would sign him so that you can go into the draft without being in desperate need of picking up that position. So it doesn't sort of tip your hand to everyone else what you're going to do. And I think in a competition next year where we're going to have 60 games, hopefully, you're going to need four wingers. And as long as he's happy to be third or fourth, and as long as Spurs use his signature kind of as sort of a backstop where they can just get it done, 1st of June, thank you very much, we've got a left winger sorted, and we can now spend the next 2 months on getting the left winger that we really want. I think it's a complete no-brainer. I mean, I think he's a far, far better player than Gil and Solomon, and if you sold the pair of them, you'd probably bring in more than £15 million, I would have thought. So financially, it works out. And also from that doesn't really make sense to connect the two, but £15 million over 4 years, if it was amortised or whatever, I see that as the money that Spurs are robbing with the additional season ticket prices. So as far as I'm concerned, fuck it.
Like, that's it's Timo's fault.
Yeah, if that's what you're saying you're using the money for to make the squad better, well, just do it then. You know, we're giving you that money, so go and get the player. I know that's not how it works, but that's kind of how my mindset is looking.
Oh, Twitter probably would disagree with that, or agree with you, actually. That's exactly how it works. What else did you pluck out of the performance? What are you thinking of Radu? Because it's... I can't remember who said it to me after the game, but someone said it was nice to have kept him in so that he hasn't got Fulham on his mind, that, you know, he gets a win under his belt playing in defence. He looks a bit shaky now and again, like there's one or two misplaced passes, but the defence is interesting, right? Because when you do have Mickey van der Ven at the back with Romero, and obviously Destiny and Porro, you think, wow, on paper, this is staggeringly good. But yet we have positionally been not very good, just in terms of the amount of goals that we have been conceding and giving up, and it's been more to do with, I don't know, actually, to be fair, just the way we've attempted to defend, the way we've attempted to play the high line. There's been a couple of reasons, but Radu as an option at the back, has he done enough for you so far? Very early in his career at Tottenham, it's probably unfair to even give him, like, you know, to rate him in any way. But can you see why we signed him? Is he a player that fits that profile at the back?
Yeah, I thought he played pretty well on Saturday, with the exception that obviously he's not very comfortable on his left side. Yeah. And in a game like that, where it's tricky because it would look bad if he was dropped after Fulham, because it would look like he's been dropped. But I think you could have quite easily made a case that playing someone like Ben Davies there on Saturday in that particular game, given how little you would have expected Luton to attack, having that left-footed centre-half might have helped us attack a little bit better. If Van der Ven wasn't going to play, which, you know, seemingly they wanted to rest him up for Tuesday, which I think is pretty sound logic from Ange. But I was really impressed with three or four times how he just got his head down and carried the ball up the sideline. And I think that helped open up the play a lot, because it was like, well, I can't pass it there, so I'm just going to run it there myself. And I thought that worked quite well. I thought defensively he was really sound. Don't think he got beaten at all. He looked, you know, strong, you know, comfortable runner.
Yeah.
But I thought probably you'd be a bit concerned, I think, if he had to play half the season at left centre half, I think. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, I'm not, you know me, everyone knows what I'm like at this point of my existence on social media platforms and podcasting and blogging. I'm not someone who's going to knee-jerk immediately on a player. I mean, we can go back to Brennan Johnson. I think Brennan Johnson is probably one of the perfect showcases for how dumb football punditry is in terms of supporters and the way that they follow football. It wasn't that long ago where it was like 50 million quid wasted on Brennan Johnson. We haven't bought an end product player, and it's just moan, moan, moan. He's rubbish. He's weak. He's not very good. And meanwhile, Brennan Johnson is actually producing the numbers and the stats, even though his performances might still not be prime performances, but he's digging deep and he's wearing our shirt. And it's just, I find it interesting that A, people are really quick to turn on someone and just decide not good enough, and B, not back their player. And Johnson is reflective of what Spurs are going through as a team. You know, look, we know that our capacity is far beyond our reach at the moment. Like we're looking up, and we know what we can produce and what we can do, and we have to be good enough to be able to do that consistently. And that is the whole point of this journey. That's the whole point of having to suffer the disappointments and having to look at little conundrums with the players that he's got, and then he's got to try and decide, what do I need to change in the summer? What do we need to do here? Do we need to strengthen in a position that we haven't really thought about, because I'm not getting the production and application from the players that I've got there right now? And so it's, I think for me, it's just that you want to see tangibles, and with Spurs there's plenty, and Radu is looking okay thus far. And we've signed some bad players in the past, so good on Tottenham for getting it right with their data and the way they're looking to acquire players that fit the profile, etc., etc. And again, with Johnson, he's just like the poster boy for what time delivers at the end of the day, and he's nowhere near the player that he could be. I mean, he it's almost like you have these weapons in your. We have these weapons in our team, but we haven't fully loaded them with bullets. And it's like, okay, just clean the gun out. You know, whatever the analogy is, probably need an American to be on the pod to explain gun cleaning. But anyway, anyone else that stood out, positive or negative, that you as you were watching the game, you were maybe scratching your chin or your head? Angie's subs, they were with West Ham in mind, right? Rather than anything tactical, or did you spot something that was required at that point? Apart from the obvious substitution at halftime.
Yeah, I thought Bentancur played well when he came on.
Yeah.
And I thought Lo Celso played well, actually. I thought we knitted the game together probably better than Maddison had done, to be honest. And look, that's a pretty brave substitution, right? Maddison is probably the alpha at the club.
Yeah,
is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And I think when you're dragging him off on 70 minutes at 1-1, which is probably in Maddison's mind where he thinks this is now my time to take the game by the scruff of the neck for half an hour and go win it for us.
Yeah,
like that's a sub that has to work, really, because it's one of those otherwise that has not repercussions. We're not at the stage where Postecoglou is going to be under any pressure, but it'd be one of those things where if Lo Celso came on and stunk the place out, you're thinking, you're trying to get a goal, we've taken fucking Maddison off. Like, what's he doing? However badly Maddison's playing, we know about his X factor. So I thought that was a really brave decision to make that change, and it worked, really.
He went straight down the tunnel, didn't he, when he was subbed?
I didn't see that, did he?
Yeah, one of the guys next to me said he's gone straight down the tunnel, and I was like, ooh, is he injured or is he pissed off? Is that, you know, and
he
I've just had a quick
see all game. He was moaning at Porro a lot in the first half about passes that he obviously wasn't receiving or wrong angles or whatever. He looked like he had the hump for the majority of the afternoon.
Yeah.
And he got into it with Barkley a couple of times in quick succession.
Yeah, no, he did. There were a few dodgy tackles being thrown about. I just had a quick look. Not that this is the way that you gauge someone's mood, but I just had a look at his Instagram to see if he's posted anything since the game. I don't think he has, but you might have posted a story, to be fair. Not that any of that really matters, but do you know what? I don't mind players being angry, because there's a reason for it, right? If you've got fire in your belly, if you're pissed off with your own performance, or if you're pissed off with the manager or your teammates, you're going to go again at Hotspur Way on the training pitch. They're all teammates. It's just part of the evolution, the pressure, the stress that you're under as a footballer. I don't mind seeing that, because he'll come out hopefully on fire for the West Ham game, because we all know how difficult those games generally are. Not so much because of West Ham, but because Tottenham often don't turn up for those encounters. Mm. I wish you all the best tomorrow when you're at the game. We get to that momentarily. I want to talk about something that you might start laughing at, because one or two people have been saying, I was in Beavertown for a very quick drink after the game, and someone said, "Oh no, we have to sign Ivan Toney now. We've got to get it. We've got to get Toney in as a number nine. We need someone who's a bit of a prick, but quality up front. He'll score the goals, etc., etc., etc. Doesn't matter what he's perceived to be by the media and other fan bases. I know most people that I've spoken to don't like him. He's meant to have a dry sense of humour. He rubs people. I mean, we know who Ivan Toney is, for obvious reasons, because of the Brentford saga, and obviously he's banned. Do you take him? Like, is this a pre-statement type of footballer? Is this like a is it a statement signing to buy someone like him, or do you think he falls into the wants to leave Brentford more than he wants to join Tottenham category, which won't align with Postecoglou's philosophy in terms of the type of player that he wants at the football club?
I hadn't even considered Toney being a signature, to be honest. Like, I don't even... So when you asked me, kind of, does he want to leave Brentford more than he wants to join Tottenham, I hadn't even given it a moment's thought that he might want to join Tottenham. He just doesn't strike me as a Tottenham player for some reason. He just oozes Arsenal to me, with his kind of mannerisms and demeanour and that sort of gait and the cockiness. It just strikes me as, you know, Ashburton Army's new poster boy. The thing about signing Toney, right, is what then happens with Son. And I know that football is a squad game now, but I'm not convinced that Son has that 5-yard breakaway pace anymore, where he can stand a guy up and beat him, like how Werner and Johnson have been doing recently, sort of from a standing start, take the guy on. I think Son is pretty, you know, it'd be difficult to take a guy away from being a centre forward when he's scored, what, 15, 16, 17 league goals already this season. And the issue with Toney is that it's going to be the bulk of your budget on a player who can only play in one position. And I don't know if that necessarily makes the whole team better if it means that Son isn't playing. Like, I'm not actually offering an opinion here. I'm kind of thinking out.
No. To be fair, some of the things you said, I've just realised I haven't probably thought too deeply about the impact of it. Because where I'm always coming from is, I always look at other teams, the teams that we're meant to be competing with, right? Because Postecoglou is ambitious, and he talks about winning the league. He talks about that's the ambition you need to have. And you might not win the league, but you'll come close to being in contention because of that ambition, because of that drive that you have as a manager, players, and as a football club. So when I look at it, and I look at Tottenham to be domestically competing, bread and butter Premier League games, and Europe, whether that's Europa or Champions League, you need a squad, and you need to be interchangeable, and you need to not drop off in quality when you're making those changes in order to retain consistency. Now, whether Toney would agree to come and then come off the bench is really unlikely. He'd definitely want a guarantee to be starting, right? Because of what we know the player, he believes himself to be a star player, star man, needs to start every game. Whereas I'm looking at it as having players that are perhaps add that depth, add that quality, you know, beyond just looking to the youth and having to wait season upon season to work out whether they're going to break through. The thing that you said that kind of triggered in my mind was, he's 28 now, isn't he, Ivan Toney? So that would mean that whoever signs him is signing him at his very peak, and we'll get the best of him over the next two or three seasons. Mm-hmm. You've arguably got Son, who's on a decline, but that could be a slow decline because he might lose the pace, but he won't lose that ability to score. So if you play a certain way to allow Son to benefit from that, then you can have Son for another two, three seasons possibly. But we also need to be looking at the future, right? And we're buying a lot of young players. So maybe I'm talking myself out of that potential discussion. Because
I think for that money, I would probably rather go after someone like Ollie Watkins, given that.
Without a doubt, that is my option.
Play,
yeah.
Off the left at games if necessary. He could play out wide and Son could play inside. I just feel like the lack of flexibility in Tony's position, and that's no knock on him, like, fair play, being a great number nine. You know, if someone said, do you want to send Harry Kane back? Obviously the answer is yes, you would do that. So it's not like I'm completely adverse to signing someone that can just play as a striker, but I just don't know if I've seen enough of Tony to necessarily be convinced that that's where I'd want all my budget to go. I want to play with no positional flexibility.
Yeah, I mean that's logical, mate. That's pragmatic. I think with Ollie Watkins, I think subconsciously, I've kind of decided that Villa won't let him go.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure you're right.
Yeah, and just I'm going to chuck this out there because I've seen people talk about it. Jack Grealish,
I'd love it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we'd have to pay for him, considering City would have to take a massive cut. And what worries me, City will probably say something stupid that Levy would agree to, like, can we have first option on Destiny? Or just something wild like that. But Grealish is a Postecoglou type of player, right? Like, he would fit into our midfield. And just, again, we've got a pretty strong midfield on paper. But I just feel the more the merrier with the 60-game season that we will, fingers crossed, have next season.
Yeah, like this probably isn't going to make any sense, but the way in which we want to play that style, you feel like it suits having Mavericks in it and having guys that want to, you know, be a part of it and take the game by the scruff of the neck, as opposed to necessarily being completely system-based players. Like, obviously, Guardiola, complete genius, and whatever he's done is beyond, you know, beyond any observation, criticism, reproach, anything at City. But it's not like he necessarily releases players to be Mavericks and to look like they're having the most fun on the pitch. It's a system that it's a system that dominates, and, you know, it is all conquering. So you can't say anything against it. But then when you do have some players, you know, the way in which Klopp wants to play, you feel like the way Klopp plays football kind of exacerbates the ability of the individual within the system. And I think Postecoglou is more within that lineage. And so I think a player like Grealish would be wonderful at Spurs. And it's Tottenham. Like, he's a Tottenham-style player. Albeit, there might be even less rationale in Grealish than signing Tony from a strictly football standpoint, with the age, the money, maybe the positional flexibility. But I don't know, there's just something about the romance of it that would just be wonderful, I think, and very, very Tottenham.
And, you know, the romance aspect is... Which is something that was abused in the last four seasons. It obviously was the very first thing that kind of brought everybody back to Tottenham at the start of Postecoglou's reign. You know, those opening 10 games, the way we felt about football, the way we felt about players like Maddison, who just took the responsibility of wearing that shirt, and, you know, and just spoke like someone that wanted to be there. And had that right energy. And you're right that the football, it does kind of amplify those traits of players in a way that we just absolutely love. I guess that's what's been missing. For a while now, we've kind of missed that kind of spark. You know, we haven't convincingly dominated a game for 90 minutes. And again, I'm not going to lose myself in those details. There are things that we can critique, and the things that we're critiquing are the things that we're hoping Postecoglou can solve with each passing game. Basically, it is interesting, the whole perception of performance and progression of a club. And again, I don't want to lose myself with social media, but I do. This is people that are around me, people that I speak to at the game. You know, a lot of people saying, well, the performances, you know, are almost relegation team performances. We're just about managing to scrape through. And I'm like, okay, just hold on a second. I kind of get what you're saying. Like, if you're literally going to look at certain negative things and only focus on them, I almost understand how your mind has distorted reality. But we are fifth. Touching distance of fourth, although we're nowhere near ever being top this season, it's not that many wins to get you in that position if everybody happened to lose their games, which will not happen. I'm not saying that scenario is playing out. What I'm saying is that with all the issues that we've had, all the problems that we've had, we're still in amongst it, and we could be far more comfortable. We could, if you look back at certain games and certain moments and certain results, and every club's going to say the same thing, but we could be sitting third now. But our expectations, in my opinion, and our evolution would still be the exact same as it is today, right this moment. Have you changed in any way in terms of, you know, how you are digesting this season and looking ahead to the summer? Because I kind of can't wait for the summer. I almost want to just, let's just take fifth or fourth now. Don't care what happens, as long as them not don't win the league. Take the summer, because I want us to build off the back of that, because I think next season we truly start seeing a change. I mean, I say that with confidence. If I'm wrong, it's doomsday. But where are you falling with how you are? Because you seem really chilled on Saturday when I saw you. I saw you before the game, and I saw you after the game. And even talking to you today, it's interesting. I could have been speaking to someone else today who could have had a right proper moan. I'm not going to mention who. So where are you sat with it all?
I'm super content. My only regret is that we had that silly spate of injuries that cost us challenging for the title. And I do think we would have been there because, you know, with 9 games to go, we're currently, as I just grabbed the league table in front of me, I don't think I'm wrong. I think we're 8 points behind. Yeah, we're 8 points behind Man City with 9 games to go. Now, look, obviously anyone can very easily say if we'd won that game, that game, that game, and then ignore the fact that you could have lost that game, that game, and that game. Yeah. But our form has been pretty consistent throughout the course of the season outside of that month where we had the absurd injuries. Like, we would have continued, we may still have lost to Wolves at home or whatever, we might still have lost them away, but I don't think we'd have lost to both all Wolves away, Aston Villa at home, and West Ham at home, and Chelsea at home without that sort of mad period. So, you know, if you added 4 points to where we were, you'd kind of feel we're in a title race at this stage. You know, distant, wouldn't win it, but we'd be right in and around there thinking, oh my God, if we can go to Anfield and win, you know, maybe we can take it into May and think we've got a chance. So, given the expectations that even I had at the start of the year, or when Postecoglou got announced, when obviously I wasn't best pleased, and you know, you lose Harry Kane. If you were told how many injuries you'd have this season, you know, the fact that in all likelihood we're probably going to get in the Champions League this year is an amazing achievement. And I find it, you know, obviously there's always micro things you can moan about Tottenham, you can moan about sport till the cows come home, it's great fun to do it. But as a general view, I don't think I've been as content about Spurs, which probably reflects how I view the club going forward. Probably I've never been this content about it, because even in the peak years of Pochettino, you know, the newspapers and Sky Sports News are filled of, well, he's going to leave, he's going to leave, he's going to leave, he's going to leave, you won't keep him, new stadium, you can't sign him, you need new players. And so that, you know, there was always, there was a finality that it felt to it, that at some point that era would probably peter out. Whereas I don't feel like that's how this era seems.
Spot on. It's where I've always been. And I'm really conscious of not overcommitting. And a lot of people, even people that are really close to me, probably think that because I play into this kind of white knight persona. Like Spurs can do no wrong ever, and that's not the case. And it's the same with Postecoglou. There's certain things that we have done, or you know, the Kulusevski thing, for example, a player that should be exploding, in my opinion. He can be so dominant on the ball and cutting in and scoring, and yet that part of his game is lost at the moment. Perhaps because there is an identity crisis, but there is also lots of little story arcs within the team that kind of need their concluding chapters to be written, and it's down to Postecoglou. So, but I know that every step is a step forward, and as uncomfortable as it makes some people feel, the club are actually doing something constructive and effective for once in terms of how they go about facilitating this evolution and this progression. We're going to stop here for the free pod. Thanks for downloading. We're going to continue talking on the Patreon pod. I want to talk about a bit more about Levy in the summer, the protest, Save Our Seniors protest that took place in the stands at the game, which is quite surprising. I've got a few thoughts on that. And a quick little preview on the West Ham game, which, Adam, you're obviously going to. Thanks for downloading. If you want to listen to the Patreon podcast in its entirety, it's Spooky in Purgatory. Patreon.com / Spooky in Purgatory. Had a bit of a brain fart there. Thanks again for downloading, and up the Spurs.